Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Truth and Honor explores the 2011 murder of St. John businessman Richard Oland, of the prominent family that owns Moosehead Breweries. The ensuing police investigation and the arrest, trial, and conviction of the victim's son, Dennis Oland, for second-degree murder. Oland's trial would be the most publicized in New Brunswick history. What the trial judge called a family tragedy of Shakespearean proportions, this real-life murder mystery included adultery, family dysfunction, largely circumstantial evidence, allegations of police incompetence, a high-powered legal defense, and a verdict that showed and shocked the community. Today, the Oland family members maintains Dennis Oland's innocence. Author Greg Marquis, a professor of Canadian history at the University of New Brunswick, St. John, leads readers through the case from the discovery of the crime to the conviction and sentencing of the defendant. Offering multiple perspectives, Truth and Honor explores this question: was Dennis Oland responsible for the death of his father? The book that we're featuring this evening is Truth and Honor, The Death of Richard Oland and the Trial of Dennis Oland, with my special guest, professor and author Greg Marquis. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Greg Marquis.
Hello.
Thank you very much for agreeing to this interview. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
I want to ask you how you came to be the author of Truth and Honor, why you were interested in this case. Can you tell our audience about that?
Sure. Well, I live in the city, or I live near the city where the murder and the trial took place, and I teach at a local branch of the University of New Brunswick. I teach Canadian history, legal history, criminal justice history, so I sensed that it was going to be a big news story, and it was a current event, not a historical case, but I thought it would be interesting for an historian to sit in on a real live case.
Certainly. Let's get right to the matter at hand, because this is a complex case, and for our largely American audience and the international audience, this is an unusual case in terms of compared to American jurisprudence. Let's talk about July 6, 2011, and you introduce a character named Maureen Adamson. She's Richard Oland's long-serving secretary, and she arrives at work at 8:45 at the building where she works, and Richard Oland does his business. Tell us who Maureen Adamson is, and tell us just what happens when she goes to the building that morning. What's her typical routine, and tell us what happens that day.
Sure.
July 6th, 2011.
Well, she's very capable and experienced, sort of admin assistant. So she was bringing in, probably a bundle of papers that she takes work home the night before. I think it was actually the morning of the 7th of July, and also some coffee, some takeout coffee, and usually would be the first person to open up the office. Kind of a nondescript, modest three-story building. In an older street in the city that is kind of gentrifying, and so when she went in, the outer door was open. That normally wasn't a big deal, but when she got to the top of the stairs, the sort of inner door to the office was open, which was not usual because usually she's the first one in. And when she entered the room, she immediately smelled a terrible smell, and she noted that a lot of things were out of place, and she soon glimpsed a leg on the floor, sort of under her boss's desk, and she panicked and ran downstairs for help.
Now, you talk about getting the assistance of Preston Chiasson, the owner of the building. And what does he do? What happens after?
Yeah, he was a friend of the owner. He was there. He was hanging out down below. The building was owned by John, and still is, by John Ainsworth, and he runs a printing and digital imaging company on the bottom floor. And I'm not sure John was there that early, but his friend Mr. Chiasson was. Often different people would drop by and hang out and do things there. And so he ran up. At that point they thought maybe if someone had a heart attack or an accident. And he soon sensed that, this is a fatality, as was revealed in court later, that had a real traumatic effect on Mr. Chiasson finding that body. He seems to have suffered from some post-traumatic stress. They called 911. Within minutes, both emergency services, sometimes called paramedics in Canada, and the local police were in the building, like within 2 minutes, 3 minutes. And they soon determined that this was an individual who was dead and could not be revived.
Now, in terms of immediate investigation, looking for signs of forced entry or robbery, tell us what police found immediately, and then what was their search entailing in terms of computers and other devices?
Sure. Yeah.
What did they
find? The case here is followed in great detail in Canada. It revealed there were some lapses in police investigation, some basic things that weren't done, but they did the usual visual search. One of the problems that day is that there were three forensic officers on the St. John Police Force, and only one was really available, so they were kind of undermanned. They also had to deal with securing the body and removing the body eventually. So there was the crime scene was on a second story office, but there was a front set of front stairs leading down to the front to the street in the front, Canterbury Street. But there was also a back alley and a back alley door. It turned out that no one thought to write down in their notebook whether that back alley door was opened or closed, or if it was closed, was it locked or unlocked on the morning of the investigation starting. Crime scene was only photographed a bit later. So they eventually did swab for blood, on the idea, hoping that maybe some of the perpetrator's blood was there, because the victim was attacked with blunt force trauma. There was a lot of blood. There were over 40 injuries to his head. And so they hoped, the investigators, that there might be some of the attacker's blood there as well. They dusted for prints. There were simply too many prints in the office, which was a working office, to have anything distinct. But there were a few investigatory lapses for sure in terms of things that weren't photographed in time, notes that weren't taken, gloves that were not worn, and also crime scene not being totally secure.
Was there any sign of forced entry or robbery?
No sign of forced entry or robbery. The only thing that, the victim had like a Rolex watch. There was cash. He had his cash, credit cards, things like that. His car keys, his BMW was parked outside. The car keys were there. They identified him by finding his wallet in his pants. The only thing that was missing, there was even an envelope of cash, I think, for a gardener on the desk. The only thing that was missing was his iPhone or cell phone, and that proved to be a crucial piece of evidence in the later trial, or two trials, we should say.
You just mentioned the 45 wounds in all. Tell us a little bit more about the attack itself. What did detectives find in terms of the crime scene and how
right.
he had been attacked? What could they assume and assess from that?
Well,
actually?
Between the detectives and also the medical examiner, they determined that he died from almost immediately from blood force trauma. It was a pretty rapid and sudden attack. A lot of people mentioned that it's probably something personal, overkill, blows around the head with some sort of weapon, some sort of hammer or hatchet. There are two types of wounds. One was sort of like a hatchet type wound. Some of those actually penetrated into the skull, into the brain. Others were more superficial. There are also round, thatched pattern blows to the head, which could have been made by something like a drywall hammer or a roofer's hammer. No murder weapon was ever found. There was a lot of blood around the body, particularly the head. There were defensive wounds to his hands, which suggested that he tried to fend off the attack. It looks like he was probably sitting at his desk, either reading or looking at his computer when attacked. His body, depending on whose timeline you believe, his body was there either from 6:30 in the evening until 9 o'clock the next day, or that's the Crown, that's his prosecution's theory. The defense theory is sometime after 7:30 he was attacked. And anyway, the body was there for several hours, so they couldn't determine a cause of a time of death. He had massive blows to his head. And again, one of those mysteries about this case is that no murder weapon and a surprising lack of trace blood in the other parts of the office. There were no blood detected on the stairs, on the door handles, on the door frames. There was a lot of blood around the body. There was a lot of blood spatter, some of it, 9 feet away from the body. But other than that, there is on one level a surprising lack of blood at the scene.
Tell us now about Richard Oland. We mentioned that he's a wealthy person involved with the Moosehead Breweries, and his family is involved with that as well. Tell us also his circumstances in terms of his marriage and his mistress.
Right.
Police
almost
immediately.
Yeah, this was revealed to the public through, as media got hold of some of the court information. But it wasn't, I think it might have been known to certain people, but Richard Oland was married to the same woman who he dated when they were 16, Connie Oland, and they had 3 children. But it turned out the police soon found that he had a mistress, and Diana Sedlicek, who was a realtor or a real estate agent. They had been involved for several years. It was kind of a bit of an open secret within the family. Richard still lived at home with his wife in Rossay, which is a sort of an upscale suburban community outside of St. John. And he gone on trips with her and things like that, and people who worked in the office knew about the affair, but it was kind of a don't ask, don't tell situation. Richard Oland had been involved directly with the Moosehead Brewery. You can buy Moosehead in the United States. It's Canada's biggest independent brewery, located here in St. John. Its roots go back to 1867. It has quite a brand recognition in Canada. Anyway, Richard had sort of had a fallen out with his own father in terms of control of that company in the 80s. He sort of lost out to his brother Derek, who recently has signed over the running of the company to one of his sons. But Richard did have shares in the company, and also in the 80s and I believe 90s, he had a very large trucking company that benefited by hauling Moosehead beer to the United States and so forth. So he sort of benefited from that. He was worth about $35 million at the time of his death. And it's a fairly wealthy man by New Brunswick standards. He involved a lot of charities and had been recognized by the government of Canada with an honor called the Order of Canada. So he was a pretty prominent victim.
Now, investigators right away find out the dynamics of this family. You talk about the 3 children. Tell us about Dennis and what they find out in terms of just immediately the relationship between Richard and his son Dennis.
Yes, well, the investigators talked to the victim's wife, Dennis's wife, Lisa, Dennis's sister, Lisa, and sister, Jacqueline, and eventually Dennis that same day. This is the day the body's found. And what they get from talking to those family members is a bit of a narrative about how Richard was a hard man to deal with. He was he could be very he had bouts of anger. He was judgmental. Sometimes could be quite callous. Towards people, and created a lot of tensions at family gatherings and things like that. So, one of the things that was stressed in those interviews was a lot of this pressure came on Dennis as the only son, and so the police were sort of given kind of a bit of a negative narrative about the father-son relationship. They also realized or came to their own conclusion that Dennis was the last person to see the victim alive, as Dennis, admitted going to see his father the evening of the crime. Dennis also, something that the police dug into a bit, and it was certainly important in the later investigation, Dennis had been advanced money from his father. Dennis was an investment advisor, sort of a stockbroker. His income was up and down. He was trying to live an upper middle class lifestyle, living in his grandparents' house, which he had purchased with his former first wife. And but his income was not always great. He was having some cash flow problems in 2011, and the police determined that that may have been a factor in the crime.
Now you talk about the money situation not being ideal, and
yep.
The relationship between Richard and the police discover is a serious thing to consider.
Mm-hmm.
When we police talked to the secretary that was there July 6th at the end of the day and during the day, what
yep.
was her testimony? What was her? What did she say to police about Dennis, about the frequency that Dennis would come around normally, typically to the office to visit his father, and what happened that day and that
yeah,
visit?
Yeah, and that's a good question, because also that person, Maureen Adamson, as well as a coworker, Robert McFadden, who was sort of like the accountant in the office, they also spoke to the police early on. Maureen testified that Dennis showed up to see his dad unannounced, not planned. He did work nearby. He lived, he worked in a building just 5 minutes away. Pleasant conversation, but she also testified that Dennis was not in the habit of visiting his father that often, at least at his place of work. Although Dennis did act as a bit of a financial advisor, making investments for his father sometimes. Dennis dropped by. He was carrying a bag with him, a reusable shopping bag, and she mentioned to him, Richard was happy to see his son. Richard had just returned from a trip, what they were going to talk about was family history. So, Maureen, within 10 minutes of Dennis getting there, kind of did her closed down routine, shutting off computers, locking the back door, things like that. And then she left the two men chatting, presumably about family history, which is one thing the two men could talk on without quarreling, apparently, was genealogy. And she thought that things were going well. She mentioned to Dennis that there was a log book, which it was basically a log, like an entry log from a family camp that had been, I think, on the mother's side of the family nearby on an island in the Kennebecasis River, very beautiful river in the area. And over the years, different visitors had signed their name in that camp log. And Richard had borrowed that from another family member to scan it, and he was a little late getting it back. So Mrs. Olin, Richard's wife, had asked Maureen to put it aside. And so Maureen asked Dennis when he showed up, well, could you take this this family logbook, please, and give it to your mother? And so, that logbook also had a role to play in the forensic evidence, as it turned out.
Now, you talked about Maureen Adamson, and what did she notice or note about his appearance and his clothing
right.
that day?
Yeah, he was wearing, it was a pretty warm day, but he was wearing a Hugo Boss, she didn't know the brand, but he was wearing a brown sports jacket, and she thought it was a little odd because it was so warm. The brown jacket, as it turned out in the investigation, the trial, was another key piece of evidence, and it focused on the issues of truthfulness and credibility of the accused. As well, it would be the only real direct forensic evidence that, according to the prosecution, placed Dennis Olin at the crime scene in terms of blood and DNA.
Now, we talk about that Maureen Adamson leaves, talks to her husband, mentions the event where she speaks to Dennis, to her husband,
yep.
and then they leave. Now, police are trying to determine, obviously, they need to speak to Dennis. You talk about that this looks like something very obvious, that they would speak to Dennis. It looks like he is the last person to speak to his father. How do police
last
approach
known person,
that?
Yeah,
how much
last,
information?
Yeah.
Pardon me?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry, he was the last known person.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do police proceed in terms of questioning him, and how much do they know? How much have they learned before they question him? Tell us about that.
There, Yeah, they're I think they're getting bits of information from some of the previous interviews that day, from the family members, maybe about the father-son relationship and things like that. They also through his interview, he mentions, for example, that after he left his father, and he said his father was in fine form and there was a pleasant parting of the ways, he walked out of the building, took a call from his wife, and then he drove home. But on the way home, he stopped at a wharf on that Kennebecasis River. And so once the police heard that, for example, they dispatched an officer that night. This is an hour into Dennis's interview. They sent an officer out just to do a quick sweep, visual sweep of that wharf area. Later, they would return with divers and a search dog team and things like that. They also did, routine things. They ran his name through the vehicle identification system. They get, the registration and plate of his car in case they could pick up any visuals of a vehicle, through cameras on the street. They also checked to see if he had a criminal record. Standard investigation. So it wasn't that he was considered a suspect that early, but they were doing some routine things to check on him. And if you watch, you can watch that in the interview. It was all voluntary. You can watch that interview on YouTube. It's been posted there. But it was about a 5-hour interview where he came in at first to sort of talk to the police about his father, see if he can come any up with any people who might want to harm him and things like that. Tell us about the victim. And about 2.5 hours into the interview, it's clearly moving into more of an interrogation. The police investigators have determined that Dennis is a suspect, and they give him a caution. They give him a caution. He has, through the course of the evening, he is allowed. He's given two calls to his lawyer. Actually, it wasn't a criminal lawyer, but a lawyer who advised him not to speak later. So for the second half of the interrogation, he exercises his right to silence, and they let him go. He's not charged of anything. One of the tactical mistakes the police made was not asking if they could have his shoes and clothing, because he claimed in that interview to have worn the same shoes and the same pants the day before. He also spoke about the jacket. We can talk about that later. The other thing that shows that he was a suspect by 11 o'clock that evening, this is the same day the body is found, is that they put a tail on him. They put him under surveillance for the next week, although we didn't really hear anything in court about that surveillance in detail.
You talk about this surveillance by police,
Yep.
but police find out soon enough that someone, his wife actually, not someone, his wife delivered some clothing to a dry cleaner the next day.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. What they find is that they apply for a search warrant, and it's probably similar in the United States. Unlike, the movies we watch and the TV shows where they get the search warrant over the commercial break, in Canada it can take it took the better part of a week, because they have to have these documents called information to obtain, where they have to give reasonable grounds, cause to for a judge to sign off. So they executed the search warrant a week after the murder on the residence of Dennis Olin, a large team of officers. In the master bedroom, they found a dry. They found and the, the jacket. By this time, they knew from video surveillance that he had been wearing a brown jacket the day of the day of the visit to his father, where when he talked to the police the next evening, he claimed he insisted he had been wearing a blue blazer. So that came up at trial as a possible lie. So the police had jackets on their mind, and this man was a professional. He had a large number of jackets and dress shirts and things like that in his closet. So the only thing of note that they found in the master bedroom was a brown jacket and a dry cleaning bag with a dry cleaning tag on it. They also found on the dresser the corresponding tag and the sales slip, and it showed that the jacket had been taken to a dry cleaner in Rosse, New Brunswick, the community where the Olins live, around 9 o'clock the morning after the police interrogation that went to 11 p.m. So that, looks suspicious to investigators. So they seized that jacket and they sent it away to the crime lab in Halifax, Nova Scotia, which is a nearby province, and the crime lab was run by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. and they did a series of tests on that jacket looking for forensic traces.
And what did they find?
They didn't really confirm to 2012 that they found four specks of blood on the jacket, and not in always obvious places. I forget the exact places. It might have been like, you know, inside the cuffs on the lower back, that type of thing, with very minute traces of DNA, and the DNA matched that of the victim, Richard Olin. So the prosecutors, however, still waited about a year before they pressed charges. So they were being, and the public was quite concerned, you know, how come an arrest hasn't been made? We're now into 2012, we're now into 2013. But the prosecutors wanted to make very sure. In New Brunswick, we have a policy where all prosecutions are cleared higher up the food chain, so to speak. If there's a good chance that you're not going to get a conviction, they will not prosecute. So they had to kind of sign off on that. So this was the key forensic evidence, DNA evidence, that was used in the subsequent prosecution.
The prosecution decision not to charge for 2 years and to be very careful to make sure that they thought they had the sufficient of evidence to lay those charges. It was also dependent on the seeming support of Dennis by the entire family, and as a result, knowing the wealth of the family, that they would mount about the best defense they could get in the country.
Fair
assessment.
Yeah, it's a wealthy family. We're not sure. Again, I would love to know two things as a researcher. What was the total legal bill, A, and B, who's paid? Now, the money, the victim's money, $35 million, went the terms of the will. I couldn't find the will, but the terms of the will seems to be that the money went in a trust to his widow, Connie Olin, but that trust could be dipped into. One of the little ironies is that Dennis Olin was one of the trustees who helped manage that trust. He was also a co-executor of his father's estate. So when Mrs. Olin passes away, and she seems to be very healthy and a very nice lady, then the will dictates that the surviving children, Dennis and his two sisters, would each inherit an equal share. Unless we have this law in Canada, I think, unless he's convicted of murder of the dead man, and in which I don't think he could inherit that share. But anyway, so we don't know. But certainly a very high profile legal team by New Brunswick standards. I mean, New Brunswick is a small province. It's located next to Maine, the state of Maine, and it's very similar, you know, kind of rural, population, small cities, that type of thing. So the typical trial here does not involve that sort of high-profile legal team. Mr. Alan Gold, one of the top criminal defense lawyers in Canada, who's based out of Toronto, and for the second trial, Michael Lacey, another slightly younger, but another very prominent and very skilled defense attorney. And outwardly, the family was very supportive, issuing statements to the media. Sometimes the lawyers would issue press releases. I mean, this is very odd, very rare for Canada, where things tend to be a bit more on the British side of things. We're very understated. You know, prosecutors do not give interviews to the press. They issue very terse statements, and everything is supposed to be sort of understated. And so we had a bit of a PR war as well, I guess you could say.
Police also gather evidence, so they're looking at forensic data evidence from telephones and cell phone towers and computer searches. But they do get some interesting information from Anthony Shaw and I believe John Ainsworth, talking about things they heard.
Yeah, that's right. Well, these are the two we mentioned, Ainsworth before, owner of the building. So they were down below on the ground floor that evening, July 6th, a nice hot summer night. And John Ainsworth was working on some sort of layout for some sort of print job. He was having a problem. So his friend Anthony came and helped them. Well, they worked on it, for 3 hours. Every once in a while, Anthony would go and have a smoke break, and they worked on it. And at some point in the early evening, before nine, they heard thumping from upstairs, and it came from the general area of Richard Olin's office, not only his office, but his desk area. And, of course, Ainsworth knew the building because he had owned it since the 80s. Shaw was a little less familiar. But they didn't think it was important enough to go check out, you know. Then he went back to work. Another man looked at his watch or at a clock, but they both told police and later in court that it happened sometime before 8 o'clock that night, because at 8 o'clock a young gentleman came in and asked if they would send a fax for him. Shaw was fairly certain that the thumping was took place between 7:30 and 8, maybe even more like 7:45 to 8. Ainsworth at first said that to the police, but then he said, "Well, I'm a little less certain. I think it's sometime between 6 and 8." So the significance of that is that the timeline is important, because cameras and other evidence clearly shows that Dennis Olin is not in the office or in St. John at 7:30 or 8:45. He's been home since 7 o'clock or so, and he's been captured on store cameras, 7:25, 7:30, 12 miles away in that Rossi area. So that in a sense, the testimony of Shaw is sort of an alibi for Dennis Olin being involved in the crime. On the other hand, Ainsworth, it also works that Ainsworth says, it could have been up to 8, but he also pushes it earlier, 6 o'clock, and he's a little less certain. So he was that difference in those two witnesses was, I think, a very big factor in the first trial. Second trial, it's a factor too, but it's more complicated.
Now, you talk about the 18 months, the investigation, it proceeded slowly. They wanted to make sure, as you say, that they had everything so that they could make a successful charge and make it stick. Tell us about the charge and the arrest and the reaction and media and family.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is that before he was arrested in the fall of 2013, a lot of people in the community kind of knew that the chief suspect of the St. John Police was Richard Olin's son. And the reason why is that media outlets were going to court and asking judges to release certain aspects from the information to obtain documents that were used to get the search warrants, because there are other warrants as well that were used here to seize computer equipment and things like that. So the argument being that once a warrant is served, then the information behind that warrant becomes public property. So normally this doesn't happen. People don't really care. But in this case, it was kind of a celebrity family, right? So we kind of knew things, for example, the victim had lent $500,000 to the suspect. The suspect was the last known person to see the victim alive. So it's kind of like, I call it almost like a legal striptease, that over the months, more and more details were revealed without naming names. And finally, it's the son. Well, there's only one son. So he's charged with second degree murder because there was no proof of premeditation. In Canada, we don't have capital punishment anymore. So first-degree murder, if you're convicted of first-degree murder, it's a minimum of 25 years in penitentiary before you can be considered for parole. Second-degree murder, I think the minimum is 10 years in prison before parole, but it can go up to 25 case by case. So he was charged with second-degree murder. So he was convicted. He's facing a minimum of 10 years. He's a man in his 40s at the time. One of the little interesting anomalies or weird things about the case is that first-degree murder would has to be built on premeditation, planning, and that type of thing. The victim was killed with a weapon. The weapon was never found. It was deemed, it was speculated to be a hammer or a hatchet or something like that. Those types of tools or weapons are not commonly laying around in investment offices. So, someone had to bring that weapon. The killer had to bring that weapon into the office. That implies premeditation, right? So again, but the best the prosecution could do was second degree charge.
Right.
Yeah.
Now tell us about we talk about normally people charged for murder, they don't even consider that person might be then getting a bail while they await that their trial. So
yeah,
tell us about that.
It varies from place to place. It's kind of rare in Canada. It so happens, it's probably the same in the States, that, you know, it's true that many murders are committed by people who, you know, it's a crime of passion. Someone just loses it and kills someone or whatever, and they often don't have a criminal record. The big thing with bail in Canada is with any issue, is like, does a person have a prior criminal record? That could be really held against you in a bail hearing. But there had been a pattern in New Brunswick that, you know, they didn't think that an accused murderer, even if they had no prior criminal record, ever been released on bail, right? So he was released. I'm getting ahead of myself. A person who had been convicted but who was appealing their sentence. I got ahead of myself there. So basically, he had a clean record. He was released on bail. We can't, you know, I wasn't at the bail hearing, and the judge who presided over the bail hearing will not release the transcript. So I would have loved to have known, because this was all under a publication ban. Everything prior to the actual trial, it probably works similar in the United States. Everything prior to the actual trial was under a publication ban, so nothing could leak out to prejudice the defense, right? So, but yeah, he was released on bail, but he had to surrender his passport, and he couldn't leave the country. But he was free to live. He was free to work. Ironically, as I point out in my book, one of the places he worked at was as a director of one or more of his father's companies. And so he, you know, for a while he was going in, and we don't know how long it lasted, but he was going in to the murder scene and right into the small office where his father had been brutally murdered, and working there in some capacity. But again, that evidence didn't come into court directly. But we do know that Dennis was doing that, because one of the things that happened to him after he was arrested is that he was fired by the company, the investment company where he worked. So he presumably got some sort of buyout, and presumably sold his book of investments to another investment dealer or stockbroker. So he was basically, you know, he didn't have a job after his arrest, although he was on bail.
Let's talk about preparation for that trial. What are the issues that the prosecution believes that they can bring up to prove, and what is the defense strategy to counter those?
Right. Well, first of all, we it's pretty well going to be trial by jury. That's the typical thing in Canada, unless something really strange happens. So they're planning for a trial by jury. The defense is using the fact that it's the last known person, you know, that the accused is the last known person to see the victim alive. They're using the somewhat fraught or imperfect father-son relationship based on three parts. One is the fact that Dennis sort of owes money to his father, so to speak, because that advance on his inheritance that he got came of a condition that he pay a monthly interest payment on that. Again, he was running a little low of cash. Secondly, possible resentment against the mistress in the family and disrespect towards Dennis's mother. And thirdly, just the general negative personality of Richard Olin from time to time. So that's a couple of things. The other one is that the missing iPhone, the cell phone evidence and radio frequency engineer evidence and that type of thing was introduced in the pretrial hearings and at the trial to suggest that the victim's phone registered on a cell tower in Rosse, New Brunswick, within a few minutes of Dennis leaving, his self-admitted time that he left around 6:30 p.m. Within a few minutes, an incoming text message from Richard's mistress made his phone ping or register off a cell tower in Rosse, which was quite close to the wharf where Dennis Olin had stopped, supposedly to see if his children were swimming there that night. So that sort of connects the missing phone with Dennis and his route home. And then things such as the dry cleaning, you know, taking the jacket for dry cleaning, it seemed to suggest, you know, a guilty mind. They call the prosecution here the Crown. You know, it's kind of the British connection, right? So the Crown attorney.
Right.
In Canada, you were prosecuted by the Queen or the King. That's what it says on the document, right? So it's not the people versus Olin. It's R, meaning Regina, I think, meaning the Queen. So they also the Crown also suggested that he lied about which jacket he was wearing. He wasn't mixed up about the jacket. He clearly knew he was wearing the brown jacket, but he wanted to, you know, he wanted to cover that up at the investigation, right? And said, and so instead he wore the blue jacket, and then the DNA on the jacket, right? The DNA evidence. So they kind of put it all together in a story that, you know, would convince a jury that, you know, that Richard Olin was a difficult man. Often this was a crime of passion. There was some sort of dispute that escalated into a violent encounter. And his son, you know, it's circumstantial, but all these sort of bricks in the wall, so to speak, point towards Dennis Olin as the killer. And again, the real legal issues, you know, what's the identity of the killer? That's the old real issue. And the Crown or the prosecutor said it's Dennis Olin.
We mentioned, but how strong was the financial incentive, and how far did the prosecution frame it in terms of motive? We knew that they found out he was in dire financial straits,
yeah.
But did they offer any theory on what that confrontation over finances may have been that day?
Yeah, the motive. This is all inferred because, you know, it didn't hold together in the second trial, but it obviously worked in the first trial. The prosecution was inferring that it wasn't that Dennis Olin, was mad at it. He didn't go to see his father. Their theory is that he went to see his father. The pretext was we're going to talk about this family history stuff because it's one of the few things we can talk about without getting into an argument, right? They relax, they joke, they both had turned into genealogy freaks. Basically, the Olin family had a connection with England, and Dennis had gone on a trip to England. He had documents, but the Crown, the prosecution argued Dennis was using the visit as a pretext to engage in another conversation. Dad, I need money. Right now, there was no proof of that, no direct proof. There were no emails, letters, phone calls, other people who could confirm or deny that. But that was what the Crown was asking the jury to believe. So they put together kind of a circumstantial evidence argument based on that, based on the situation. And you know, again, that was kind of a powerful argument, I think, put in front of the jury.
Yes. Let's use
and the father, you know, and again, the inference of the father not refused and maybe said something nasty and things escalated and boom.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Let's use this as an opportunity, Greg, to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is ShipStation. When you're selling online, getting your orders out can be a real pain. Time-consuming, expensive. So many carriers to choose from. How do you know you're making the best choice? That's why you need ShipStation.com. It's the fastest, easiest, and most affordable way to manage and ship your orders. ShipStation helps you get your orders out quickly, save money on shipping costs, and keep your customers happy. No matter where you're selling, Amazon, Etsy, your own website, ShipStation brings all your orders into one simple interface, making them really easy to manage from any device, even your cell phone. ShipStation works with all of the major carriers, including USPS, FedEx, UPS, even Amazon Fulfillment, so you can compare and choose the best shipping solution for you and your customer. They even offer big discounts on shipping costs. Now, any business can access the same postage discounts that are usually reserved for large Fortune 500 companies. You'll always know that you're getting the best deal. No wonder ShipStation is the number one choice of online sellers. You'll ship more in less time with the best rates available. And right now, True Murder listeners can try ShipStation free for 60 days when you use promo code TRUEMURDER. There's absolutely no risk. You can start your free trial without even entering your credit card info. Just visit ShipStation.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in True Murder. That's ShipStation.com, then enter promo code True Murder. ShipStation.com. Make ship happen. Now, Greg, we were talking about the trial itself.
Yep.
How interesting feature of any trial is when a defendant takes the stand. Tell us about this first trial. Tell us about his turn on the stand.
Right. And I just might interject, too, to explain to American listeners and people from other countries that in Canada, you can't have any cameras in the courtroom.
Right.
Right.
Good point.
And also, you can't talk to jurors after a trial. So it really makes it a little more challenging to do the research and things like that. Dennis, yeah, so you often hear seasoned lawyers say, well, I'm not going to put my client on the stand. You know, they don't have to. There's a right to silence. You do hear about trials where people don't testify. But he wanted to testify. He wanted to sort of clear his name. And there were also some suggestions, actually more than suggestions, the defense did say that they were going to put Olin family members on the stand as well. That created a lot of interest because here you have an elite family whose intimate secrets, you know, were being pried into by the media. And so we weren't sure if it was going to be character witness sort of testimony, but in the end that didn't happen. Dennis himself went on the stand, and he was examined by one of the senior lawyers, Gary Miller, who was a New Brunswick lawyer, very seasoned, and it started with the first question was, did you kill your father? No. And the last question was, did you love your father? Yes, right? And that testimony tried to revisit his timeline of where he went and what he did on the day of and the evening of the crime and possibly the next day as well. But it also, in contrast to the more negative father-son relationship that was stressed by Dennis in his original police interview back in 2011, this
right
gave a kind of a rosier view of the father-son relationship that, you know, oh, dad was a bit of a character, but, you know, he was, you know, on many levels I admired him. He was, you know, we had a lot in common. We loved cars. We like, you know, skiing, boats, whatever, right? So that, you know, I think that was trying to sort of repair that damage that possibly the defense saw the police interview having created. It's interesting, the second trial, the defense tried to have the whole interview excluded. Right, so obviously they saw that as a problem, but the interview went in, the first 2.5 hours went in, and again, as I mentioned earlier, after he had been cautioned and given, you know, read his rights, so to speak, by the police, although he was not arrested, then Dennis didn't talk very much. But, you know, it's also possible to, you know, a lot of people like to read the body language and things like that. People have all different views of that. But, you know, if anyone's interested, they can find that Dennis Olin interview on YouTube and watch it themselves and see what they think.
Mm-hmm. Let's get back to this first trial and his performance on the stand. But what happens as a result in that first trial?
Well,
what is the verdict?
Spoiler alert, it's a conviction, and the jury sits for about 3 days, and a lot of court watchers were, you know, thinking it was going to go the other way. At the time, I thought it was going to go the other way just based on my sense. I mean, I am an academic, but I'm also not legally trained, and I thought that the defense put up a strong case and seemed to be more aggressive, even reporters, I think, although, you know, off the record, were sort of expecting it was going to be an acquittal. But I was there in court that Saturday, just before Christmas, too, which is, you know, added another layer of emotion, perhaps, to the outcome. The jury came in and announced that he was convicted, and you know, understandably, some people in the family are quite upset. And the judge then, you know, ordered him to stand up and taken right into custody, and then to be brought back in the new year for sentencing. Because, as in the States, I'm sure there had to be a pre-sentence report, some recommendations on sentencing,
right?
And so then he was whisked away, and he was held in over Christmas in provincial jail. And then after sentencing, he was sent to a federal correctional institution.
Now, this is why this story doesn't, it has so much more legs to this in the story.
Yeah.
What happens there? And what, by the way, we didn't mention his sentence. What is the sentence he receives?
He got the sentencing February. He had no prior record. He seemed to be a good candidate for reform. The public, the judge agreed that, you know, the public was not really in any danger from him and that type of thing. So he got, and the jury itself recommended a minimum, right? The Crown asked for a little bit more, maybe 12 years or whatever, but in the end, Justice Walsh agreed that 10 years. Now, 10 years, you know, that's kind of close to a manslaughter sentence, right? So 10 years, which still is quite a shock for a man in his, you know, a middle class man, or anyone really, to be heading in for 10 years in federal corrections, where you're in there with convicted murderers, rapists, right? So he, what happened to him? He, for a while, he was all federal inmates in Canada are sent to a classification prison in Nova Scotia, a place called Spring Hill, which used to be a mining town. And then after a certain time, they are sent to appropriate places. Now, as if someone convicted of murder, he's sent to a more maximum security place where there's a lot of hard cases. And that was Renouse in New Brunswick, which is a northern New Brunswick. It's called the Atlantic Institution. While he was there, he was assaulted by two young, during a visit by friends or family in the family visit room. He was assaulted by two young inmates from Nova Scotia who, as I explained in one version of my book, were members of these loosely affiliated gangs in Halifax, where there's Halifax, Nova Scotia is big enough to have a little bit of a gang scene because of the drug trade, and they assaulted him. He had to go into sort of a sick bay or whatever there, and he didn't press charges, but the institution pressed charges, and eventually those two young men who were in their 20s, who were in for fairly serious crimes, they pleaded guilty to assault, and they were sentenced to 4 months to be served concurrently with their much longer sentences. Dennis Olin did not put in any victim impact statement to that incident. So he's convicted December 2016. Prior to the sentencing as well, a hearing, the defense announced that it was applying for leave to appeal, and they did appeal to the New Brunswick Court of Appeal on a number of grounds about the fairness of the trial. And the New Brunswick Court of Appeal agreed to hear that appeal. So that appeal was heard in Fredericton, New Brunswick, which is the provincial capital, in the fall. And by this time, of course, Dennis has been in federal prison for several months. The defense also launches an appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada because of an issue of bail. Remember, we talked about bail before, but Dennis was in prison, having been convicted of second-degree murder. His lawyers argued that when he's launching an appeal, he should be freed on bail. And that had almost never happened in Canada, definitely not in New Brunswick. So there were two appeals underway. One was to try to get a new trial or to have the first trial overturned, and appealing all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada to establish a legal test for bail.
Right. Now, regarding his appeal for another trial, what was the result?
That was successful, and I attended some of that. I mean, these appeal hearings are it's highly specialized. The judges aren't, you know, the judges take briefs and read them, and they don't talk about all the issues in the courtroom, but they issue a decision. He was granted a new trial. I mean, the defense had hoped that the conviction would be overturned, but it was a new trial instead, and it was based on a passage in the judge's charge or instructions to the jury at trial.
Right.
And it had to do a very technical thing. It had to do with reasons why a defendant might not be telling the truth. And a layperson would find this hard to maybe get the nuance of, but it had to do with there could be other reasons why someone is lying that aren't related to the crime, right? So a very narrow thing, but the justices in the New Brunswick Court of Appeal thought that the trial judge had made an error, that the trial had not been fair, so a new trial was ordered. In the meantime, both sides appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada. The Crown or the prosecution wanted the Court of Appeal ruling to be overturned and wanted the conviction to be restored. They didn't want to fight a second trial. And the defense, although they had scored a win on one level with the Court of Appeal, they wanted the Supreme Court of Canada to say, wait a minute now, this guy should be freed, right? No new trial, let's just have an acquittal. But the Supreme Court in the summer of 2017 informed the two sides that they were not going to hear that case. So then the two sides started planning for round two. In the meantime, Dennis, he's out on bail, doesn't have his passport, can't travel out of the country, but he's free to work, use his boat, whatever he wants to do with his family and friends.
You write about the support of the family for his defense, but also that this person that was flat broke, this couple that was destitute, it was a different thing after his father died. Tell us about that.
Yeah, what's interesting that, I mean, this was not ever entered into evidence at trial, only indirectly through some of the documents at sentencing. But, you know, Dennis, again, to be fair, he probably did get some sort of buyout from his job and things like that. But, you know, in the months after the father died, they bought a building, an older building, ironically, one street over, you know, connected by back alleys from the building where the crime had taken place. Lisa set up a vintage clothing business, which seemed to be successful for a bit. A high-end, I say vintage, you know, it's gently used, things like Louis Vuitton handbags and, you know, Hermes scarves or whatever. And he bought a boat. He bought a used cabin cruiser. I forget the brand, but it was a fairly big boat. He went on some trips, several trips. And so, again, it for a guy who supposedly was broke, it just seemed a little jarring from the point of view of a researcher that he was doing these things before he was arrested. So he wasn't laying low. And we don't know where the money came from, but again, he probably had some sort of buyout. Life went on. His kids were, you know, in high school and university, and his wife was involved in the business. She also got involved with an art gallery in Uptown St. John, and the other owner and manager of that gallery was the wife of Dennis's cousin, I think, possibly Andrew Olin, who's his cousin, who eventually took over Moosehead. I think I'm correct on that one. Anyway, so, you know, life went on, and the Dennis and his wife attended social events. They're involved in different things, and they belonged to two yacht clubs, and they had their boats. They had their circle of friends. Lisa was involved in these two businesses, so they didn't seem to be sort of hiding out before or after the arrest, right? In 13.
What do you make of the family's unabashed support of Dennis, despite this trial, despite this evidence?
Yeah.
And then with this financial support, what's your take on this?
Well, again, I mentioned earlier, we don't really know, you know, who's paying and what the bill is, but it certainly, if it's, you know, two trials, all the preliminary hearings, and we don't have grand juries here defending the trial, but we have there was a preliminary hearing, which is sort of by a judge, and it decides whether to send things to trial. We have pretrial hearings on evidence called voir dires, and we had at least six of those for the second trial, and you know, so it adds up. So we don't know, but the family, you know, we haven't heard of anyone in the family or the family circle saying anything in public about doubting Dennis's innocence. And he's had shows of support from friends and things like that. At the sentencing hearing in February of 2016, he had, you know, there were number of prominent people there, including, he didn't come into the building, but standing on the steps outside was a person who was a Canadian senator at the time, just speaking more about what the family was going through. So a lot of the attention at times seemed to go on Dennis, and sometimes some people pointed out that there wasn't much attention to the victim. Although with the second trial, I think the family tried to pay more attention to the victim, who was a member of the family.
Now tell us, tell us about the latest surprise twist in this. Not in the book, but this is the latest development in this case. Tell us about that.
Well, there's two surprise twists. One was that after a lot of hard slogging, the trial was slated to take place in the fall of 2018. And one of the things that the defense tried to get was they wanted, first of all, change of venue to another city and or a judge alone, because they argued there was so much advanced publicity. I mean, there were two books. There were lots of social media. There was tons and tons of newspaper, TV, and radio reporting. There was a national broadcaster, CBC Canada, had an hour-long documentary, The Fifth Estate, called Murder in the Family. There's a documentary film crew working on the case now, right? So they argued, you know, we can't get a fair trial in St. John. So they did some polling. They hired a company. Again, this speaks to the deep pockets. They hired a company to do polling of opinion on what to think of Dennis Olin. They tried to get judge alone, and they couldn't. The judge ruled against them. Then what they did get, though, they got more robust questions to ask potential jurors. It's called challenge for cause. We have a different system in the States. Yours is way more intense and laborious. We have, you know, it's a kind of old school. Jurors come in, they're asked three or four questions. The two sides get a few challenges. I forget, you know, how many the defense gets and how many the prosecutors get. But, you know, it's a somewhat, I wouldn't call amateurish, but it's an old-fashioned juror screening system here. What they wanted was to bring in social science evidence, the defense, to try to do, to allow the people who were, quote, trying jurors or selecting them to screen them for potential bias. And so they did win that. You got a more robust system of juror selection questions. So they got a jury. They called 5,000 people to get a jury of 14 and two spares. That's a large number of people by Canadian standards. Then the twist, there's two twists coming. The big twist is just before trial was going to begin with this new carefully screened jury, the Crown, the defense found out that the police officer, who was kind of like the file officer or records officer in the case, had overstepped himself by using a crime management system database to check on the jurors. Now, it's perfectly legal and appropriate for the police to check jurors to see if they have a criminal record, because sometimes they will not always say, right? In Canada, you're not supposed to be on a jury if you have a criminal record. So he was just doing his due diligence here, double checking, but he went a step above and used this internal database, which showed any involvement with the police at all as a victim, as someone who phoned in that there was a cat in the tree, someone who was pulled over for having a bad taillight, you know, that type of thing. And so there's a whole issue of disclosure there and that type of thing, and then possibly tainting the process. So it turned into a bit of a drama. So it was all behind the scenes, of course. The lawyers and the judge conferred. And so when the jury walked into the room that day in November to begin what they thought was going to be a trial that would last several months and possibly deprive a man of his liberty for several years, after they were thanked by the judge and told that they could go home. And he declared a mistrial. And so the option was either, do you start over to try to get another jury and call another 5,000 people, or do you go to judge alone? And the Crown, with great reluctance, agreed, because in Canada, the Attorney General has to sign off on any request for judge alone, right? And that wasn't being done. So anyway, so they decided they're going to go ahead judge alone, and the trial started judge alone, which is exactly what the defense had wanted the second time. And so this misstep by the officer sort of gave them an early Christmas present, you know, to use that sort of figure of speech. So then the trial went on. It stretched over several months. It didn't sit as many days as the first trial, but it stretched over a longer period of time. Judge alone trial, they did a lot of mutual agreed upon statements of fact. They replayed video evidence rather than bring in witnesses. They actually just replayed some of the video of witnesses from the first trial. They had more exhibits, right? There were a few things that were different, but from the Crown, it was basically the same case by the Crown. There were a few different tactics, a few different witnesses, and in the end, Justice Terrence Morrison rendered his decision. It was about a 140-page written decision, so that's different because the juries here don't give reasons why they acquit or convict.
Right.
In fact, if they do, they can be arrested. Here you have a 140-page document explaining every aspect, and the judge ended up acquitting Dennis Olin of first-degree murder, and he was a free man. And that was, just recently, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was interesting, though, is the statements by the judge about this, beyond reasonable doubt of his innocence.
Yep.
Tell us what he said. Considering.
Yeah, that was interesting for me as, again, a non-legally trained person, but I guess there's case law on this as well because he cites it, and the first judge in the jury trial did cite some of these court cases to try to explain reasonable doubt and the difference between, suspicion and probable and that type of thing, and this Terrence Morrison actually incorporated some of that same language, but he said, remember the first judge said something similar that he told the jury, if you think he might be guilty, that's not good enough, right? So the judge in the second, in this decision, actually has several passages in his written decision saying, I didn't totally believe Dennis Olin on this point, that point. On this point, he was incredible. On that point, he was incredible. However, overall, I believe that the prosecution did not prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. And he picked apart different aspects of the prosecution's case. For example, he thought their theory of motive was not really proven by the evidence introduced in court. He believed that the blood expert for the defense was more credible than the blood spatter expert for the prosecution, and the difference being there is that the blood expert for the defense said, well, wait a minute, based on my many years of experience working for the RCMP, you would have more blood at the scene, and also the attacker would have been covered in blood. Their clothing, their shoes would have been covered in blood. Whereas the Crown witness said, well, there have been cases where someone gets close in with a close-in weapon, there's an attack, and the attacker is not always covered in blood. They also, the judge also believed that the cell phone evidence, which many people thought was very crucial, was not that credible. He didn't, he agreed with a lot of the defense counterattack on that cell phone evidence because a lot of that cell phone evidence was based on modeling and predictive mapping of how cell towers communicate with cell phones in their radius, and it's not 100% accuracy. It's more of a forecast. And so that created doubt in the judge's mind as well. He found that the financial aspect as well, he says something like, well, maybe the average person would have been upset and stressed by their financial situation if they found themselves in the same situation as Dennis Olin, but it's not proven that Dennis Olin was actually upset, right? So those are three or four key sections in his decision. The other thing that was interesting, too, a lot of people in the community, of course, the defense was always attacking the police investigation for being inadequate and insufficient and amateurish and that type of thing. The judge did acknowledge some of that in his decision, but he said ultimately that's a neutral factor in my decision.
Oh, incredible. One last thing. How did the judge dismiss the blood droplets on the jacket? How did he explain, or how did he account for that?
That's an interesting one too, because everyone loves DNA, right? To follow that, but he agreed with the defense that there could have been other reasons to explain how that blood and DNA material got there, nosebleeds, whatever, right? So he didn't. He again, I think for with him that the lack of evidence. The lack of visible blood, right, on the victim's clothing, on his shoes, in his car, because he got immediately after seeing his father, you know, he left the building, took a phone call, you know, at 6:35, got in his car and drove home. There was nothing in the car. The car was searched for 15 or 16 hours. There was nothing in the red grocery bag, no blood or DNA. So, you know, I think a few people might scratch their heads at that passage in the decision, but he argued that this other evidence seems to kind of almost wipe out or undercut the DNA. And the DNA, it is the victim's DNA, but there's no proof how it got there and how long it had been there. And of course, those two things are impossible to prove with current DNA science. The timeline
is extraordinary.
The timeline, I don't want to take up one last thing. The judge was also, he said, because the timeline is so conflicted, he can't determine a time of death. And that's a very crucial reason in his decision.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Very, very interesting. It's very interesting, too, the interpretation when we talk about circumstantial evidence and people saying, well, there's only circumstantial evidence. Canada, the Canadian judicial system seems to put much more weight on the solving or the answering of certain questions, almost to seem the reversal of how a prosecution or a judge might view it. This judge almost seems to dismiss some of the evidence brought by the prosecution, like you say, in favor of the defense, and says, well, there isn't proof.
Yeah.
Like we just mentioned, on an alternative reason why the DNA, I mean, of course, you could look at it that way and say there's no evidence why that was there. But I think an American judge and jury and even media would look at this much differently. And I find this case and this story quite shocking, actually.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because people need time to digest this, and as well, it'd be interesting to have some more legal commentators, you know, look at that. The proof will be like within a few days. The prosecution has a deadline to apply for an appeal of the ruling. Although the grounds for an appeal from the prosecution are quite narrow compared to the defense. But you know, I think you've hit on the possible area that they might look at. Who knows? But you know, because this is one case, I can't say how it stacks up against other DNA cases, because you know, DNA is supposed to be the magic bullet. But obviously, you know, in this judge's mind, all the pieces of the puzzle are not sufficiently strong for a conviction. Although he sees a lot of merit in aspects of it, and again, all the language in both cases was this idea of building a wall with bricks. Like, circumstantial evidence by itself is can be good evidence, but there has to be enough of it, right? And obviously the jury in the first trial thought there was enough, right? The jury in the first trial thought there was enough. This judge disagreed, right? So interesting, same evidence, jury in one case, judge in the other.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. Yeah,
it's a very, 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 very fascinating case and verdict, actually.
And it's you know, there may be more to the story. We'll find out soon with the appeal process.
Yes, very, very, very interesting. I want to thank you very much, Greg, for coming on and talking about Truth and Honor, the death of Richard Oland and the trial of Dennis Oland. It's been fascinating. Is there a Facebook page or website where might people look for this book specifically?
You can get it through Amazon. It has been released in the States. Also, it's on a couple of talking book platforms. I forget which ones. Audible is one, and maybe another. So the 2016 version is hardcover. The 2017 version is paperback, and that is the version that's been made into a talking book. And I just found out last week that we're doing an updated version, an updated paperback, that this sounds crazy, will be out in October, because they just asked me to do it last week. So there'll be kind of a third edition. I also, you know, if you Google, you'll find, you know, different aspects of YouTube and things like that, and different news clips and things like that. But yeah, there'll be sort of three, at some point soon, there'll be three different editions of my book. I think it was released in the States. I know I've done a little bit of radio promo there in the past. So you can order from Amazon, you could order from the publisher or just ask your local bookstore.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Greg Marquis, for Truth and Honor, The Death of Richard Olin, and The Trial of Dennis Olin. It has been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the chat.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.